Good morning, everybody, and welcome to The Journey Home with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And we're going through Ken Wapnick's book called The Journey Home, and it is a discussion of the obstacles to peace. And so it's going to be a lot of fun. We've just started a couple of weeks ago, and so I don't even know what page we're on, but because I'm reading mine on a Kindle and Bruce is reading his on an actual physical book, whatever those things are. And
you know, Treeware has its place.
It does. As a matter of fact, especially if you have no Wi-Fi signal. Treeware is amazing if you have no Wi-Fi signal.
Uh-huh.
It's all very cool. So how are you this morning, Bruce?
I'm good. Yourself?
I'm great. I have my grandchildren over. They are here for the weekend. So I did get a lot of sleep last night because, you know, trying to get them settled in and stuff. But, you know, maybe I'll make up for it today. When they take a nap, I can take a nap. That's the fabulous fiction that most moms tell themselves. When the baby's napping, I can either do the dishes or take a nap. Which should I do? Yeah. But it's cool. It's great. It's good to have them over, and they're here for a couple of days because there's a big marijuana, a cannabis convention in Denver. So my daughter and her boyfriend both work for a dispensary, and so they're off at the convention. And so, you know, I never thought I'd say these words in my lifetime, Bruce. I swear to God, this is the most amazing thing. That my kids are at a cannabis convention in Denver.
Well, you know, we've lived to see some strange and interesting things. In the last few days, I learned that my niece, who was always a whiz kid, is now the vice president of a company that looks poised, in my mind. I haven't really kept up with the industry, but when I worked as a hardware and software engineer for a company called Grass Valley Group, which is part of Tektronix, a few decades ago now, just a decade and a half at least, anyway. We used all kinds of expensive equipment, including, you know, some that were made by the parent company, Tektronix, Hewlett Packard, you know, those the big names. And because of my niece's expertise in modern physics and laser interferometry and measuring gravitational waves in outer space, and she helped, you know, demonstrate that there was an echo to two black holes colliding a couple of years ago. It was featured on TV and such.
Wow.
Anyway, she's helped. She's now the vice president of this company called Moku Labs that's making this little box about the size of a mini Mac. You know, it's like you know, about the size of the book that we're reading out of. You know, essentially. And well, you don't have a book, but you know, the physical Treeware version, and it does, you know, essentially a dozen different test and measurement types of functions: oscilloscope, spectrum analyzer, waveform generator, time domain reflectometer, you know, all that kind of stuff. I'm speaking engineering buzzword speak, but things that used to take up large, you know, baby elephant size packages on carts that you hauled around to engineers' desks if they had room or typically had you put next to your equipment that you were designing in the lab, and these would all cost tens or multiple tens of thousands of dollars each. And she helped design this, you know, with her knowledge of the physics involved. This one box does all that. You just put a little iPad, dock it on top of the thing, and it'll measure all. Yeah, but I was just blown away and impressed. I'm thinking, man, if I was Hewlett Packard or Tektronix, I would be scrambling to try to keep up. But anyway, it was just kind of fun to see this little demo video of what my niece has been up to. So we're very proud of her. But it's just, you know, again, another example of how, you know, our world doesn't stand still, and you know, things keep changing because that's the nature of change. Everything, you know, nothing in the dream stays the same. But you know, we can have fun with the dream, but just not take it so seriously. And so that's, I think, you know, in the point of what you and I are doing with this program is to you know, appreciate things that are happening in the world, but not make a big deal out of them, and just say, wow, isn't that interesting, and then be passersby, as Gary Renard's teacher's Art in a Person suggests.
Exactly, and you know, the more and more we see how this really is just a dream and it's a projection of our thinking, that's for me been the big shift, is to see how much a projection of my thinking the world is, and mm-hmm. So, you know, even you know, you're projecting a thought that, you know, this little small box of whatever it is, magic, this little box mm-hmm. full of magic,
right.
has some meaning to, you know, our lives, our futures, our hope for more, you know, better technology. You know, it's almost like today's lesson, which we're talking about our attack thoughts, attacking our invulnerability. But really, it's basically all of our thoughts that are saying there's not enough or I need more, and looking at, you know, better, bigger, better ways of doing things is really, well, it is an attack thought. You know, even though it seems like a good thing, it sounds like a good thing, and we're all happy about it, and I'm not unhappy about it at all, it's still saying something in this world doesn't have complete power. Something that I need is incapable of doing exactly what I need to have done. I am, you know, there's a lack here. There's something small here that needs to be replaced or repaired. And so let's make this magical thing to do that, or that magical thing to do that, when all these are just workarounds trying to make this house our home. And
substitution.
Exactly. something about how you said substitution. Where there's a remember that. Oh my God! What is the name of that movie? It's a Disney movie, it's about the war during World War II, and the Germans were coming or something, and there was this magical lady or this magical situation. I can't remember the name of the movie, but I'll think about it, because there's a song that they sing, and it's Substitutionary Locomotion. It's the song Substitutionary Locomotion. Anyway, it's about how you can take the energy from one thing and instill it into something else and make it move the way that you expect it to move or want it to move. And they in doing this, they made a bunch of imaginary soldiers out of just clothing or whatever, sticks and things, and they got up and they fought, and they were substituting for real soldiers. So, I don't know, I'll have to look that up, because somebody maybe can help me with that, the name of that movie.
Sounds interesting.
It is interesting. It's pretty damned amazing. A Disney movie about magic and the war. Anyway, I love it. So let's take a look at our book that we're reading, The Journey Home. Dr. Kenneth Wapnick. And can you tell me the page that we are on?
We're on, I think we got to almost the bottom of 16. So how about if I back up a little bit and read a couple paragraphs?
Okay, that sounds good.
Okay, I'll start at the top of the page, because okay. I think that provides good context. And it's, as we learned, repetition is a good thing when it comes to right-minded ideas and rereading course material, because of our enormous resistance to looking at this. And just like you say, you know, today's workbook lesson really, I was kind of wowed by it too, and thinking, wow, how profound today's workbook lesson is, because it's, you know, the depth and breadth of our attack thoughts, and how many things that we are, you know, consciously or unconsciously fear that really keep our dream world in place as an identity, and you know, keep us imprisoned by our own thinking, our own choice. It's kind of staggering. So anyway, this ties right in. It says, so we're at the top of page 16 in Ken Wapnick's The Journey Home, The Obstacles to Peace, and A Course in Miracles. And it begins, in truth, nothing has truly happened, talking about the Big Bang in the previous paragraph, For as A Course in Miracles teaches in an important principle, which will become central in our later discussion of the obstacles to peace, ideas leave not their source. In other words, the idea of a separated world has never left its source, which is the separated mind. Yet the son believes that the ego's plan has worked, because immediately upon the projection, the ego caused a veil of amnesia to fall over the son's mind so that he forgot where he came from. In psychological terms, we would call this denial or repression, or more expressively, the veil of forgetfulness. The consummation of the ego's plan is the making of the body, which now serves as the son's, quote, final home, unquote, his ultimate self-concept, a little less for self. The body is seemingly governed by the brain, and its fate and condition appear to be determined by all sorts of influences, including genetic, physiological, psychological, educational, environmental, social, religious, economic, and political. I would add technological to that, too. Thus, whatever happens to the Son of God is no longer the result of his decision in the mind, for instead he perceives himself as a body to be the innocent victim of forces and powers beyond his control. I'm thinking of the theme to the Bosom Buddies TV show, which is a Billy Joel song. I never said I was a victim of circumstance. Anyway, there's nothing he can do to change his sorrowful fate, the effect, because its source, the cause, has so cleverly been placed beyond his power of decision, it seems. He now has become totally mindless, the final step in the ego's brilliant strategy. If the son has forgotten he has a mind, which is the cause of all the painful effects of his life, there is no way he can ever change it. In a telling passage on the ego's use of time, Jesus explains how the cause of sin is past, or in the past, is beyond all hope of change. And this is a quote from chapter 28, which brings us up to, I think, where we left off. Time neither takes away nor can restore, and yet you make a strange use of it, as if the past had caused the present, which is but a consequence in which no change can be made possible because its cause has gone. Yet change must have a cause that will endure, or else it will not last. No change can be made in the present if its cause is past. Only the past is held in memory as you make use of it, and so it is a way to hold the past against the now. So, we're just continuing to dig the hole that we believe ourselves in deeper every time we, you know, lament the fact that our circumstances seem to have a hold over us, forgetting that it's our mind that put us there.
Exactly.
In a dream.
Exactly. And as I read the other day in a very profound posting on Facebook, if you find yourself in a hole, stop digging.
And along the same lines as if you see someone else in a hole, tie a rope to a tree and then throw the other end down into the hole and wave and walk on, or maybe help the person climb out if they need a little help. And it's keeping in mind that there's nobody else out there, and we're really just helping ourselves, taking the form of helping someone else. And since there's no one else out there, there's only one of us in the room. And rather than throwing in a shovel or more dynamite to add to the commiseration, and I think that's what pity really is. You know, what we really think of is sometimes as compassion really is pity, where we make the error real for someone else, which makes it real for us too, and that doesn't do either of us any good. It doesn't mean we can't, wish someone well when they're ill or that sort of thing, but the idea is to, simultaneously hold in mind the fact that in truth nothing happened to disturb our peace and reality, and it's only a temporary dream state in our mind that we appear to be suffering from, and we get back to that decision-making fulcrum point in the mind where we throw the big knife switch over from ego to Holy Spirit, and the sparks fly, and suddenly the floodlight kicks on, and the cockroaches scurry for cover, and the ego's mind. Then it's like, oh, hey, the dream's over, game over. That's okay, but it's really more of a gradual process because we don't do it all at once. We have little bursts of forgiveness, little bursts of remembering to not take the dream seriously, and then eventually we say, man, this is pretty nice. I think I've actually been more peaceful while I've been actually doing what the workbook lesson suggests, and look at my attack thoughts and see that they're, you know, the basis for vulnerability, and why would I want to attack that invulnerability?
Anyway. Yeah, and you know, this is my little class that I do on Saturday mornings before I come on with you. We just go over this lesson and talking about how it really is the whole idea of taking a look at any scenario, any thought that you have about something that is going on in your life or the world, and follow it to its logical conclusion, which means you just say, well, if I break my leg, then I won't be able to go to work. You know, so I broke my leg, I can't go to work. If I can't go to work, I won't get paid. If I don't get paid, I won't have money to buy food or groceries or pay the rent. If I don't pay the rent, I will get evicted. If I get evicted, I will live on the street. If I live on the street and it gets cold, then I might freeze to death. And there I am, dead, just because...
Right, or you could go a different route. If I get cold on the street, there might be somebody come along. They'll ask me to use my skills to, devise a Death Star for the Earth, and it'll blow up the Earth, and it'll form a chain reaction and blow up the solar system and the galaxy, and then it'll spread to the galaxies, and then da da da.
Wow, yeah. That's some serious attack thought going on there.
That's really the essence of it is we're afraid that our entire cosmos is going to come crashing down if we start forgiving. I mean, that's really the ego's insane,
yes,
you know, misunderstanding of things.
Yes. That is absolutely true.
I think that's where the wisdom of what Jesus does in his brilliant course and his magnificent workbook, because he, you know, in this particular exercise, he basically says, I'm concerned about blank, I'm afraid blank will happen. You know, that thought is an attack upon myself, because that gives us an opportunity to look at how crazy, when we start extrapolating and following the outcome of our fears to their illogical conclusions, we see that, you know, that's just a really whacked out thought of mine. Doesn't mean that we don't express in behaviors that reflect a peaceful concern, but then we're not invested in the outcome when we're doing that. That's the big difference.
Yeah, absolutely, and that is the big difference. And so this is what he's talking about, because we think the cause of everything is the past. We think that what you're saying to me now is only possible because of something you learned, language, you learned social skills, you read a book, you have, you know, I'm thinking this situation right now where you and I are is caused by a lot of things, and that it will cause a lot of other things to happen in the future. But the reality of it is that all of this is part of the script. It's all here. There is no if then this, or there's no past to look to for reasons, and there's no future to look to for solutions. The reality of it is, it's a frozen timeline. It's basically not changing because of, you know, I make a different choice now. The only thing that can change if I make a different choice now is that I can move into another timeline where those things don't happen. Or I can move, and that's, I think, what happens as we practice forgiveness and we begin to see that the effects that we're experiencing are not caused by any action or inaction on our part. The effects that we're experiencing are a part of the dream. And, I mean, that's it. You know, stop dreaming, you wake up, where does the dream go? It's gone. It doesn't exist except in your mind.
You know, that whole matrix or web of you know, unimaginably complex cause-effect relationships that we think of that, you know, govern the material universe that we live in. You know, within the Newtonian, like you say, within each quantum so-called reality, you know, those are, you know, the script is fixed. And you know, like Gary's experience when he went to Cahokia with Artin and Persa, and then he actually went there, and I say actually in quotes, and quote, in person, unquote, sometime later, and he realized, oh, I'm experiencing the exact same sequence of, I mean, literally exact same sequence of events that he had experienced in a mind trip with Artin and Persa, and he tried to change something about it. He couldn't change it. But that's because within that particular Newtonian, if you will, script or sphere of reality, that script is fixed. But with forgiveness, when we start changing our identity by listening to the promptings of the Holy Spirit, forgiving, you know, all the specifics, and then learning to generalize, it seems like we're actually, you know, expanding, you know, popping out to make some jumps to other spheres that have a different script, and within each of those, it's fixed. But eventually, I think we'll pop out to the outermost, if using the metaphor, which is going to fall apart quickly. But you know, essentially, you know, some way, of course, as God takes miles, we realize we're limiting ourselves to any dimension or sphere or whatever at all, and we transcend that in ways we can't even imagine. And that's, I think, what we're drawn to, because we know that there's a peace beyond anything that surpasses understanding, as has been said. And we're all inexorably drawn to that. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't have ever cracked these books.
That's right. That's right. And what I recognize... Oh, here, turn off my alarm. What I recognize from all my attempts to manipulate the script and try to change things and make things different, you know, all I'm doing is frustrating myself, because no matter how much I want my room to be painted pink, right now it's painted blue. And unless I can change the color and you know, get a paint and put it on there, it's still going to be pink. Well, actually, it's blue or whatever. That's falling apart too. But so it's all my thinking about the world. It's all my thinking about the situation. It's all my imagination about the outcome and imagination about the cause. You know, I think, we are so simplistic in our attribution of cause and effect. We look at something and say this happened because of that, but I had a vision once when I was, you know, in my teens, actually, and I can't even explain it to you, so there's no words that go with it that had to do with rocks and mountains and things. But, I mean, that's what I was seeing. But what I saw was from the beginning of time. I absolutely saw in this vision from the beginning of time, and I saw the what we consider cause and effect. Everything that is an effect that seems to be happening right now came from that one very first beginning. Now, I didn't know at the time that one very first beginning was a tiny, mad idea, but I did know that there was something that that somehow or the other got this whole thing rolling, and that the end of it is also just as fixed as the beginning. There is no, you can't change the outcome. And so all of these things that are, and it had to do with rocks and mountains, because I saw, you know, mountains rise up and rocks come down and sand and, you know, it was like the life cycle of the rock is what I saw. But in my mind, it was, you know, this is how things go. None of this would have been if this hadn't have happened, and everything that happened after that is set in stone. And I became, you know, what they call a fatalist at that time. I just recognized that I can't change anything that's going to happen, and the only thing I can change is how I see it. That didn't mean I didn't try, because believe me, I was, you know, trying to make effects all over the place. But I knew for a fact that that was just silly effort on my part, because it all is happening. There is nothing you can do about changing the script. The only thing you can do is walk out of the theater, which, you know, now I know, but I didn't know at the time. I didn't know what the solution to it was. All I just knew was, you know, it's going to go on until it's done. And ain't none of us going to change any part. So wait, enough of that. So I'll continue. Let's see. Did you read Thus the Sun's Original Decision? Or just the...
Nope, that's the okay. one.
All right, I'm going to pick that up then. And just that you just read from text chapter 28. No change can be made in the present if its cause is past. Only the past is held in memory as you make use of it, and so it is a way to hold the past against the now. As attack the now with my past thoughts. Okay, so he says, Ken says, thus the son's original decision to be a separated ego is protected by the defenses of projection and denial. His only hope, the power of his mind to choose the Holy Spirit, is an all but distant memory, and one that is seemingly beyond his capacity to access. What has indeed happened is that the son now finds himself in a body with a separate physical and psychological identity and has no memory of how or why he arrived here. His brain, programmed by the ego not to remember that he is nothing but guilt's shadow, and that's from text chapter 18, begins to conceive of all kinds of explanations about how his physical life began. These explanations, which have preoccupied the time and effort of our greatest brains, psychologists, philosophers, theologians, physicists, biologists, etc., are all wrong, but since they but study the effect, the body, in parens, and are totally unaware of the cause, parens, the mind. Okay, by making the world, when I say parens, I mean in parentheses, by the way. So,
parental discretion advised?
Yes, right. So, but the making of the world and the body serves another very important purpose, alluded to above. The projection of the one Son of God from the split mind is accompanied by the fragmentation of his Son into billions and billions of fragments, as described in this clear statement from the text. Okay, you who believe that God is fear made but one substitution. Oh, and by the way, that was substitutionary locomotion from the movie Bedknobs and Broomsticks. And okay. Angela Lansbury sings it. So. Okay.
And while we're doing a quick aside, I was hearing Carl Sagan read that last sentence. Billions and billions, billions of fragments.
You can't help but hear Carl when you hear billions.
I'm channeling Carl.
Okay, you who believe that God is fear made but one substitution. It has taken many forms because it was the substitution of illusion for truth, a fragmentation for wholeness. It has become so splintered and subdivided and divided again over and over that it is now almost impossible to perceive it once was one. And still is what it was. That one error which brought truth to illusion, infinity to time, and life to death was all you ever made. Well, that's it. The only thing we ever did. It's over.
Doesn't mean we should stop doing what we're doing. It just means, interesting.
Yeah.
We're making a whole lot of fuss over
it. We're making a big old mess.
Nothing, as Shakespeare says.
Your whole world rests upon it. Everything you see reflects it. And every special relationship that you have ever made is part of it. You may be surprised to hear how very different is reality from what you see. You do not realize the magnitude of that one error. It was so vast and so completely incredible that from a world of total unreality, had to emerge. What else could come of it? Its fragmented aspects are fearful enough as you begin to look at them, but nothing you have seen begins to show you the enormity of the original error, which seemed to cast you out of heaven to shatter knowledge into meaningless bits of disunited perceptions, and to force you to make further substitutions. First prediction of error outward. The world arose to hide it, and became the screen on which it was projected and drawn between you and the truth. And that's from text chapter 18, the introduction. So,
good stuff, huh?
Really,
you know,
good stuff.
The word enormity kind of jumped out at me as you were reading that second last paragraph. And I was thinking, from the perspective that we see ourselves, from our dream character identification, obviously the cosmos seems enormous. And yet, with Of Course in Miracles and hints by inspired voices such as Gary Renard's teachers, Art in a Person, you know, what we really are is everything, and it dwarfs the universe of time and space to nothing. You know, by comparison, it's nothing. In fact, in truth, it is nothing. But we only gradually, I think, come to recognize that when we start looking at the insanity of the world and realizing that there must be not only another way, but another identity where we go beyond shared interests to identical, an identical self, ultimately, that we can't even fathom, but we get glimpses of, where we recognize that the peace and the ecstatic, joyous recognition of everything as self, it transcends anything we could possibly imagine, including the material world that we have so entrenched our minds to believing that we're residents of. But it's a pretty impressive hoax. It's an enormity from our perspective, but it's nothing from the Holy Spirit's perspective. And the Holy Spirit, a.k.a. our inner kindness teacher, also known as the awareness we took with us into the dream to, follow the breadcrumbs or the string in the cave, back out to the entrance to get to the light again. That awareness recognized that it's just a whole lot of nothing going on. So, anyway.
Exactly. So you want to read on?
Sure. Each individualized and specific fragment hiding in the world appears to have an identity encased in a body all its own and separate from all the others. Because of the almost infinite number of fragments that inhabit the universe, salvation of all of them appears to be an impossibility. The evidence to the contrary seems so overwhelming that the fact that the sun remains one and can only be one is no longer remembered. Well, until we discover the metaphysics of the Course, pure non-duality, right? It is this characteristic of separation and fragmentation that allows the ego to take the repressed sin and guilt in the sun's now fragmented and individualized mind and project it out onto a specific person other than himself. And this then becomes the ego's purpose for the body. For because of the dynamic of projection, the sun is able to fulfill this part of the ego's strategy of keeping his individuality, but not the sin. Not my mind's backyard. Possessing the additional self-concept of the innocent victim, the capital S son, is able now continually to project his unconscious sin onto another, thereby believing that he is free of it. Finding sin and guilt in another thus becomes the secret purpose of everyone's life. Now, reading that, the
wow.
Capital S son, it's almost like we're, Prince and the Pauper sort of thing. We're really this one prince, disguised as many, but we have this dream of pauperhood, and it's a facade, it's a masquerade. We're this glorious self that we can't even imagine. It's the grandeur and the magnificence that is so far beyond the scope of our everyday thoughts that we just have, as Ken was pointing out here, what we just read this morning. We've banished it from our thoughts almost completely. There's a few little glimmers, and it's those little sparks that this curriculum fans into a flame again to essentially vaporize the barriers that we put in our mind and reveal to us that this real identity is what we are and what we want. And we, through forgiveness, we see greater and greater glimpses of it every time we let ourselves and each other off the hook and undo that whole victimizer duality, projection craziness. So.
Yeah, and it's just so amazing as you're talking about it that, you know, that is, it doesn't matter who it is and how much you love them and how what a great relationship you have or what best friends you are or anything, you are going to find things wrong with another person. Everybody, because of that, this very condition, is going to look and find something that they object to.
Yeah, Lynn, I'm pretty upset now.
You're pissed.
Now that you mentioned it, yeah, I'll find something.
Well, I mean, honestly, it's a crazy thing, but you know, given the opportunity and actually given an upset, you know, so you know, I don't have anything against you right now, Bruce, but you know, if you
10 seconds, right?
I'm holding out my judgment. You know, what have you done for me lately? But oh my goodness!
But that's I think the crux of how we get out of that quagmire is watch the ego's crazy thoughts, and they're sneaky, they're slippery sometimes. They, you know, there'll be just a little thought that says, "Oh well, I wish it was he or she would do this or didn't do that." You know, and once you start going down that road and making your peace of mind contingent on someone else's behavior or identity or appearance or yada, you know, the possibilities are endless and the varieties, because the ego fragments and it's so talented at that, you know, are seemingly unsolvable. And within the dream, it is unsolvable. That's why we need help from outside the dream, which of course calls. Course in Miracles calls the Holy Spirit, or you know, represented by, you know, its poster child for right-mindedness, Jesus, as you know, the author of this channel material, and why it works, because you know we actually have to have something outside of our very limiting self-concept in order to, you know, turn that, you know, throw that giant knife switch at the, you know, the Son of God thinking he's the Son of Man, you know, and return back to right-mindedness where we, you know, recognize our true grandeur and identity, and the only way we can do that is by sharing with everyone, and you know, most of the time the way we get back to that is by looking at our thoughts of victimization and whether it's we're on either end of that equation and forgiving all the imagined slights and wrongs and you know, the arrows of outrageous fortune that you know seem to beset us in the world, and even just you know just the most minor little thing, you know, a little twinge of annoyance or irritation, those if we identify with those things, they become the perfect part of the ego strategy to reinforce the unconscious guilt and keep us trapped. So finish that paragraph.
Okay, go ahead and finish that paragraph.
Okay. So I think we left off. Let's see, other than... Okay, I'll reread that sentence. Okay, the Son is able to fulfill its part of the ego strategy by keeping his individuality, but not the sin. Possessing the additional self-concept of the innocent victim, the Son is able now to continually project his unconscious sin onto another, thereby believing that he is free of it. Finding sin and guilt in another thus becomes the secret purpose of everyone's life. The hidden dream, as opposed to the outer dream of the world. And once these persons are found, a little red book, black book or whatever,
right.
a noir book, how's that? Their names are added to the grievance list of victimizers, held in safekeeping in the Son's mind against the time when God inevitably breaks through the defenses and confronts him with his sin. Thus, at the moment of his death, the Son can say to the avenging God, with all the justification of the innocent victim, it was not I who sinned, but this sinful one. picture outstretched arm with finger pointing, right? Okay. Look at how I've been victimized and unfairly treated. You know, woe is me. And out comes the list, his list, compiled in blood, sweat, and tears, and maybe a few other last century rock groups, over lifetime suffering, to present to God, so that he would cause his wrath to fall on the, quote, true sinner, unquote, leaving the innocent son free to walk away with his individuality preserved and another's condemned by sin. So there's the strategy, pretty vividly laid out by Ken there, isn't it?
Yeah, it is pretty vividly laid out. And it's also very easy then to look at that and say, every single one of these events, everything that happened that led me to this particular outcome or this particular point of view came from a thought in my mind. And, you know, so the thought in my mind is that, you know, you're not giving me what I need, or you're doing something I don't like, or, you know, all you know, it's what do I need, what do I like, what do I want, what do I think is personally reprehensible to me, what do I think is loving to me. These are all ideas that we have about, basically about ourselves. It's an idea I thought about myself that says, oh, I can't stand it when that happens, or I don't like this particular, you know, kind of coffee, or, you know, whatever it is. It all comes from a point of view that there's something that is acceptable and something that is not acceptable. There are things in this world that are good and things in this world that are bad, useful or helpful or whatever. And as we were talking, I had to look it up. I was reminded of a cartoon, believe it or not. Here I'm, must be in cartoon thinking today. That I remember when I was a kid being just terrified about it. But it was a story about a little bat who fell from his, you know, whatever, where bats were. And he was walking around and there were mice. And the thing is called the flying mouse. I just looked it up. There were mice around him and they were saying, well, what are you? And he was saying, well, I don't know. And they were saying, well, you're nothing. You're not like us, so you're nothing. And then they sing this song, you're nothing but a nothing, you're not a thing at all. And it's real menacing. They're real menacing to this poor little bat who, you know, was basically, you know, he could have flown away. He was a little mouse with wings. But I'm thinking about that's our life. We go through that and say, ooh, that's different from me. Oh, that must be nothing. You know, that's not what I wanted. That has no relevance. That's nothing. This guy doesn't believe the way I do. He doesn't. He's nothing. He deserves nothing. You know, and that's how he doesn't deserve my love. He doesn't deserve my respect. He doesn't deserve my forgiveness. He doesn't deserve my help. You know, this is what we're doing when we're looking out at a projected world that is different and therefore, you know, guilty. And then we can make up our own decision about the fate and eventuality of that person or that situation. And, you know, I see myself doing it every single day. I can turn on the TV news and I can say, he is nothing. He deserves to be in jail. He's done terrible things. He's different from me. He doesn't think the way I do. You know, do I ever think, oh, wow, here's a person who's just in, you know, complete abject terror because they're so confused about the world. And,
in the projection of my own.
Yeah, and a projection of my own abject terror.
Yeah. Challenging. It oftentimes can be a little more challenging.
Yeah, well, and it is. Because, you know, then I see, oh, and I'm the one sitting here being afraid. Oh, I'm in abject terror. I'm the one who's seeing this. I'm the one who's expecting this kind of behavior. I'm the one who's condemning this thing. Because he is a nothing. They are a nothing. They don't compute. It doesn't look like anything to me. Like they say in Westworld, when they see something that doesn't fit into their worldview. Of course, they're robots in Westworld, so you know they have a very limited worldview. Huh, how can that be us? Anyway, we have this very limited worldview, and if it doesn't fit in that very limited worldview, then the only thing we can do is condemn it. We can't accept it and love it and give it space and let it grow and let it be, and you know, we have to kill it. You know, that's our that's how we see about things. Oh, a spider. You know, a lot of people just kill a spider right off the bat. Boom. And to me, you know, I look at a spider and think, oh, here's my little friend. He's going to keep aphids off my plants or whatever, you know, he has a use for me. But it's all my opinion. This is all came from a decision. And this is what Jesus is going to talk to us about in the obstacles to peace, is our decision to be less, our decision to be something that we're not, and to expect the world, and the world does, follow our lead and give us what we ask for. So, do you want me to read, or you have anything else to say about that?
I always have things to say, but we could read. I mean, there's just so many places we could go with this, but I think the fact that we're right at the threshold of, you know, the entrance to this whole book, really, this everything we've read for the last few weeks has just been, you know, getting us prepared for this next section, which really, you know, it begins the major content. So we've gotten the scenario set up, and so now we're going to look at those obstacles in tremendous detail over several hundred pages. Yeah, but that's important to do, I think, because, you know, if we kind of look at, you know, how all those things go through our mind through the day, you know, all, like you were just talking about, all the criticisms, all the condemnations, all the you know, the trash talking, not only of others but of ourselves indirectly. And then, you know, today's workbook lesson, I think, also mentions that, you know, it's whatever comes from us also goes through us, and we're affected first. I think that was one of the most important points, certainly an important point in today's workbook lesson, is that, you know, whatever happens in my mind, you know, sort of like if what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, well, if what happens in my mind stays in my mind. Ideas leave not their source.
Exactly.
Maybe there's room for a new bumper sticker. What happens in mind stays in mind. I don't know how popular that one will be, but
well, at least until it's released, it does.
Yeah. But you know, because, you know, ideas don't leave their source. But watching those, you know, that trash talk, watching the criticisms and the condemnations and the judgments and the irritations and the annoyances and, you know, all that stuff, and just seeing how each one of those thoughts keeps us anchored to an identity that doesn't bring us peace. That, making that correlation and watching over time, you know, like doing a statistical analysis of, okay, which thought system seems to be working. if we can separate ourselves from egos tampering with the test results by listening to the Holy Spirit, we discover that, you know, measuring the data from the actuality of when we're truly at peace and when we're not, we would discover that the only time we're not at peace is when we are putting obstacles in the way. And we do that by our lack of forgiveness and by our unwillingness to look without condemnation and use the Holy Spirit's awareness to give us that lucid insight. So, do you want to go ahead and read the next paragraph?
Sure. Okay. So we're starting, this section is called The Obstacles to Peace. And so, thus it is that the ego is able to keep its separated existence intact through establishing the mindlessness of the sun, protecting this self through its formidable defense system. The four obstacles to peace, which comprise the heart of chapter 19 in the text, are the focus of this book, provide a summary of this brilliant strategy. Chart B, which I don't see, but it's in the appendix, expresses this strategy of layering the defenses so that they cannot be undone, for each defense covers the preceding one, which remains in unawareness and thus incapable of being noticed and changed. We leave for chapter 9 in this book a discussion of this chart, which is pages 229 through 235, and that would be in the FIP version, which, thank God, keeps consistent with its page numbering.
Yeah, and a quick aside there, the annotation, there's a new page on the FIP website. If you go to Foundation for Inner Peace, and in fact, let me go to it right now. and then go to the ACI, which is ACI.org, and go up to the menu on the right and look under, let's see, it's under, where is it? I think it's under Foundation. No, it's under ACIM, and then Annotations. And that basically describes, in much the same way that the FACIM .org site does, how to use the annotations. What's cool about that is for two reasons, and I'll make this aside quickly because I know we're running out of time. If you refer to a place in any of the three volumes of the supplements, there's a standard notation, and you can use that notation called the annotation system. It's very logical, actually, and it just doesn't take long to master. And when you do that, though, anybody speaking any language for any of the 27 and counting translations, or any of the different formats, including the three editions of the English version and all the different digital formats, no matter which of those you're using, in which language and which format, which device, which media, you get to the exact same place. And so that's why I've been sort of an enthusiastic proponent, let's just put it that way, of the annotation system, and I try to use the correct annotation wherever I can, and encourage people who are doing things online particularly to use that, and if where possible, link back to the FIP site, especially the workbook, because you can link to the exact workbook page, and then people will know right where to get the full context of things. So anyway, enough of that aside. So.
Yeah, I appreciate those annotations myself. But some people look at them as being unnecessary rules, and you're trying to cause me to learn how to write correctly in the English language or whatever it is that they think the annotations are doing. They really are very helpful, and believe me, I use them relentlessly all the time. I'm using the annotations to figure out where things are. It's such
cool.
A gift. Yeah, it is a gift.
It really is a wonderful gift because, both the format and the language, variables are essentially just knocked out of the equation in terms of being a barrier to people. So given that we have an international audience for this material, I think it's really helpful, particularly.
All right, and Jim Dunn is going to go have breakfast. Have a great breakfast, Jim Dunn. I love you, brother. Okay, so we leave for Chapter 9 in this book a discussion of this chart and the specific role the ego's layering of obstacles places in its whole thought system. Suffice it to state briefly that each obstacle, beginning with the first, expresses a layer of defense the ego uses to cloak the layer that lies underneath it. The general plan proceeds as follows. Okay, here's how it works. I won't tell you all about it. The ego begins with a non-existent problem, in parens, loss of its individuality. That's the non-existent problem, which requires a non-existent defense, which is, in parens, sin, guilt, and fear, which then itself becomes another non-existent problem, in parens, God's wrath. requiring yet another non-existent defense, in parens, the world and the body, requiring yet more non-existent defenses, known as special relationships, to protect our physical and psychological selves. And on and on and on it goes until a whole thought system and world, macrocosmic and microcosmic, are erected, governed by the principle of keeping the Son of God as far away from his mind as possible so that his thought system can never be changed. So these are like the layers of insulation.
I'm picturing Wile E. Coyote setting this perfect trap for the roadrunner, and then smugly, dusting his hands off as he walks away, and with this mischievous grin, thinking, I've got it all figured out now. Right?
Exactly.
We know how that turns out.
Yeah, and it always turns out because it's the only way it can be. Right? It's the only way it can be. Okay. working backwards, then we can see that the obstacle for the fear of God but begins the process of teaching the son that his mind is fearful of the loss of his individual identity. The inevitable result of believing in the reality of sin and guilt. Obstacle 3, the attraction of death, proves indeed that his wrath means our certain destruction. This necessitates making a body and world in which to hide. Obstacle 2, the body is valuable for what it offers, wherein the body's feelings of pleasure and pain root the Son of God, the Son, in the belief in its quote-unquote reality. Finally, obstacle 1, our desire to be rid of peace, expresses our ongoing need to suffer so that someone else will feel guilty. The attraction of guilt, establishing ourselves as innocent victims who are powerless to alter our tragic fate. Wow. And that's a huge, that paragraph is huge. And, yep. The story that it's telling from backwards to forwards here is that this first thing, the desire to get rid of peace, which always just confuses people when they first read it. What the hell? Why would I want to be rid of peace? And then you start looking at, why would I be wanting to be angry at this guy? And why would I want to think that that person's guilty? And why would I wish that it was warmer instead of being so cold? And why would I, why would I do anything to object
to what?
There's
a madness behind it, isn't there?
Yeah. I'm doing it.
Why. Since we've just about run out of time, I think we ought to reread these first three paragraphs next week.
Okay.
Just because it would set it up again. And even though we've been seemingly backtracking a few times in our very slow warm-up to getting a momentum in this book, I think there's so much in these early pages that bears repeating that it might be worth it.
Okay, so let's just start this section, the four obstacles of peace, again next week. Sounds good to me. I put my Berker marker right there. So
that's good. I'll be back in Oregon. I've been in California for a couple of weeks, next Saturday. And I wish everyone a great, peaceful week. And you can always find me on acimblog.com. And I look forward to our next conversation, as always, Lynn.
Thank you so much, Bruce. And thank you, everyone, who joined us this morning. Glad to have you all with us. Right now, I'm going